We get used to fires burning across the landscape every summer and fall now in California. Fire season itself is predictable, but over time, fire shows some surprises. As we learned last September, a strong wind can make the difference between a fire burning into ashland and a fire burning in completely the other direction. Fire and weather are close companions in a relationship that works in two directions. Let's learn all we can in a bit more than 20 minutes from our two guests. Eric Christensen is a retired federal fire behavior specialist based in Boise. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. And still working is Robin Heffernan, who is with the National Fire, well, she's with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration as a National Fire Weather Science and Dissemination Meteorologist, also based in Boise. Robin, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, Jeff.
Let me ask each of you in turn then, starting with you, Robin, how much has the science in this field been added to in recent years? How much more do we understand about fire and weather and the ways they work together?
Well, we're always continually learning when it comes to the fire and weather interaction. Over the last decade, really, the latest science has really been working on coupling the actual modeling of this atmospheric and fire interaction, right? So we've witnessed it on the landscape forever, and now we're actually starting to be able to model this feedback mechanism of a fire creating its weather environment, what that weather environment then would do to that fire behavior and so on.
And I wonder, though, that as events change and we get drier and drier conditions, for example, if the models hold up or if they're constantly having to be adjusted based on new information.
Oh, they are constantly being adjusted. Everything in the modeling world is constantly being adjusted, right? It's a never-ending process of improvement. Every time you find a bias or an error or something like that, we are continually adjusting and improving the models. When it comes to fire behavior and the weather, there's so much that goes into it. There's all the atmospheric elements, but then you have all of the vegetative elements and the landscape cover and the moisture and the vegetation and all of that that goes into the behavior. So there's so many inputs and outputs that it's going to be a constant process of improvement trying to model this.
And fire behavior has always been an interesting term to me, Eric Christensen. I mean, how much work does somebody have to do just to understand it, to be able to begin to do this? What kind of training, for example?
Boy, that's a loaded question. there's a lot of us started as wildland firefighters back in the day. Most of us have professional degrees, typically in natural resources and then in fire management in general. And then we've been on overhead teams and in hotshot crews and burn slash and gone to continuing education kinds of classes. And it's a long process, and I don't know any fire behavior analyst, including myself, that would ever say that they have it all figured out.
Well, and that raises the question then about, in recent years, are fires doing things that they did not use to do, in your experience?
In my experience, no, they're not doing things that they didn't used to do. But what is happening is that we have more extreme fire behavior than we did, say, when I first started 40 years ago, more days in every year that we can have extreme fire behavior. But the kinds of fire behavior that we're seeing, the physics of fire behavior really hasn't changed over time. We just have more fuels on the ground, more hot, dry days, a longer period every year where fires can burn extremely.
So there's some predictability to it, I think, is what I'm hearing. It's just that you got so much more stuff in there to make this happen.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Let's not forget that because we've been so good at putting out fires, especially throughout the Western United States in about the last 100 to 150 years, we have an extreme buildup of fuels in many of our environments of the West. You couple that with warming climate, the more hot, dry days and so forth, and we can predict reasonably well fire danger over time. So we know that going into the summer without the spring rains, for example, in the Northwest, and then we had those really hot temperatures, we knew that we were going to be in some severe fire weather and some very extreme fire behavior this summer.
Eric Christensen and Robin Heffernan are guests on the Jefferson Exchange, two experts in fire behavior and meteorology, and you can join the conversation on the Exchange. Your questions are welcome at 800-838-3760 over the phone, 800-838-3760, you know it well, and the email address jx@jeffnet.org. Robin Heffernan, just in terms of pre-fire conditions, how out of norm are the numbers you're seeing in temperatures and fuel dryness? I mean, all the things that can contribute to a fire, an intense fire.
Yeah, we're pretty far out of the norm when it comes to the climate conditions going into the summer and even what we've experienced so far. You know, we've had just hot, much above normal temperatures in many locations, numerous records as far as the temperatures go with the hot conditions this summer in the West. Going into the summer, we've had excessive drought, borderline record in some locations as well across the West, particularly in California and the Intermountain West. So, yeah, as Eric said, we knew coming into this fire season that this was going to be a rough go with regard to, you know, the expected behavior and fire danger that we were looking at coming into this season. Of course, we all know right now we're experiencing some good rains in the Southwest, so that is a good relief for those areas down there. Of course, the fringe areas, though, as that lightning moves north, is where we're starting to see our new fire activity.
Well, and then I wanted to ask about that because I was looking at some of the materials that have been out there this year, just about general conditions and forecasts, both near-term and three-month, and noticing the fact that the fire danger is actually somewhat lessened by the monsoonal rains in the Southwest, but that moisture comes north, and then what's the whole process it sets up, Robin, that creates lightning storms in the Northwest?
Yeah, so it's kind of that moisture from the monsoon, right? You've got the four corner states that are pretty well covered right now, you know, off and on with some heavy rains, right? They're getting frequent thunderstorms in those areas, and they're getting heavy rainfall in some areas, flash flooding. So that moisture, though, in the atmosphere continues to move beyond that area, right? It's moving north into the Great Basin. It's moving into the Northwest and into the Northern Rockies. And as it does, depending on how much moisture comes in, if it's just kind of a limited amount of moisture, that might be enough to create some thunderstorms in an area, but not enough to really produce some heavy rainfall with that. And when we get those thunderstorms without the heavy rainfall, that's really where we see our greatest threat for new fire starts, is when we see, quote, dry lightning. So we know these fuels have been dry for some time. We know we've had very hot conditions. And then if you get some lightning in the area, even if it's got some limited precipitation with it, it still has a very good likelihood of starting fires. So that's kind of the area we are in right now. But every now and then, this moisture is surging in heavier, right? So then we're going to see some heavy rains. We saw some in the Great Basin this past weekend. So it's kind of an ebb and flow with regard to this moisture. Also, relative humidity levels, right? We know what that is with regard to just our day-to-day weather and how muggy it feels outside. Relative humidity plays a huge role with regard to fire starts and fire behavior. So if we get those even just relative humidity levels to increase, even if we don't see precipitation, if they increase at the surface and they stay increased for a period of time, that is a significant improvement when it comes to the ability for these firefighters to get a handle on these fires.
So does the declaration, for example, of a red flag warning hinge upon numbers like what the relative humidity is expected to be?
Absolutely, yeah. In order for red flag warnings to be issued, there is an agreement between the local fire authorities and the National Weather Service in that local area that will determine what relative humidity levels, what temperature levels, what wind. Of course, wind plays a huge role when it comes to fire movement, what wind levels and stuff like that are hazardous, and determine what levels need to have a red flag warning issued for them. Good thing to remember, though, with a red flag warning always is it is a kind of a conditional probability, right? It's the weather conditions are there, but the ignition isn't necessarily there. So it's if a fire would start or if a fire is ongoing in this location of the red flag warning, we anticipate to see extreme fire behavior.
And one of our listeners has pointed out we could use as many syllables and as many words by just saying hot, dry, windy instead of red flag warning. Are they the same thing?
Well, sometimes they are. Yeah, sometimes a red flag warning can be out for hot, dry, and windy conditions. Other times they could be out for very unstable conditions, meaning that the atmosphere is very unstable, and if a fire were to start, it would grow rather quickly because of that instability. Other times red flag warnings are issued for excessive lightning and the likelihood of numerous new starts across the area.
Okay. Again, we're talking to Robin Heffernan from the National Weather Service, NOAA, and Eric Christensen, a retired fire behavior specialist, both located in Boise. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Eric, let's talk about fires that make their own weather. I mean, is this about the size of the area that's burning? Is it about the intensity? What kinds of variables create a pyrocumulus or some of those other tall stacks? Clouds that come out of a fire?
A lot of it, Jeffrey, has to do with scale. But I've seen, for example, pyrocumulus clouds form over top of large machine piles. If the atmosphere is unstable enough and 75 or more percent of heat from a wildland fire is convected upward, Usually, a fire gets going, a big fire gets going because it's very windy, but at some point in time, the power of the fire is greater than the power of the wind. So the cumulus or that updraft, that convected heat goes up and breaks through the wind layer and forms a large cumulus cloud. It's mostly white because most of what's in that smoke column is water vapor. It twists while it's growing, and because of that twistingness and because of that instability in the atmosphere, it's very difficult to predict where the fire is going to go. And when a fire is plume dominated like that, we can't do anything safely, hardly, especially on the leading edge if there is one, or the flanks. So we typically fall back operationally.
All right,
So
when you have a pyrocumulus, you're saying those are really dangerous conditions?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then it's that danger can be exacerbated when that column collapses, because suddenly there's a great downrush of air, not unlike an outflow of a thunderstorm, for example. And that can push fire in any direction whatsoever. So, during the formation of a plume or a pyrocue, and then when it falls apart, that whole scenario is pretty dangerous for on-the-ground firefighters.
Now, this is pretty much the same mechanism that creates regular thunderstorms, isn't it? Just perhaps faster?
It's the same mechanism. Robin can probably answer that question better than I, but it's the convecting of heat upwards, and there's instability, and there's moisture accumulating.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about convection, Robin, because basically when the earth gets warm and the air goes in a pretty stiff upward movement, it's going to pull moisture with it too, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And then as that air rises, it cools and condenses, and that's what typically forms our clouds. In our thunderstorms, and the amount of updraft or air moving upward will create kind of the energy in that thunderstorm. As Eric just described, we get that movement, that convection of air moving upward that is enhanced significantly from the power and heat of the fire.
So we got the same mechanism essentially that creates thunderstorms just going on with fire, but now these then can create their own weather systems. They can create lightning and even tornadoes. Is that right, Robin?
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, it is rare for pyrocumulus clouds to produce a significant amount of lightning or a tornado, but it does happen. And that it's the same mechanism. Like I said, it's the convection that's moving the air up. If you have a very extreme, violent, really movement of air upwards because of the fire, it's going to create a vacuum at the surface, a localized low pressure center, and that's what starting to create the vorticity or the circulation of what could be a fire tornado. We really talk about the difference between a fire whirl and a fire tornado. Fire whirl is something where you have that vacuum at the surface and you're getting that circulation, but it's almost like a dust devil, of course, in fire, though, almost like a dust devil, and that is not connected really to any type of atmospheric circulation. It's really just surface-based. When we say we have a fire tornado, that means that there is a connection between the surface to the clouds in the atmosphere and the thunderstorm there of that circulation.
All right. So is one generated by fire and the other not?
Well, Fire Whirl is, yes, generated by fire and the low pressure center. The difference between the tornado is that the thunderstorm is actually supporting that structure,
okay.
Whereas a fire whirl, you're just really having the support from the ground and the fire itself.
And either one of those creatures, Eric Christensen, I'm going to guess firefighters keep a very great distance between themselves and it.
Exactly. When the fire whirls themselves are generally much smaller. But they can spread fire across our line, or they can impact firefighting operations. They're generally a lot smaller, but they're certainly quite dangerous. The plume dominated fire or the fire cumulus, much larger, very difficult to predict the direction and spread of fire. There's generally quite a great deal of wind because that cooler, moister air is being drawn into the column. So we feel that wind. And then when we feel that wind stopping, then we know that that column's about to collapse. And that's when we know that we have to get out of there because that cold, air will then come down with a great deal of force, could spread fire everywhere. And that's the most dangerous part.
So I'm getting the sense that a fire that starts with significant intensity is probably going to get significantly large simply because the ability to get a handle on it early on is limited.
That's often the case. Using some of the local fires that we've had in Southwest Oregon in the last several years, starting with Sober Fire, Biscuit, Checko Bar, now Bootleg, difficult access, steep, complex topography, exceedingly dry fuels, and usually a great deal of wind at the start. That's why we can't typically catch fires early. And then if they grow to be a certain, a large size, we get these plumes created, oftentimes several times in an afternoon, and that just exacerbates that fire spread and growth.
I have a couple of questions about the sets of numbers that get used, Robin Heffernan. One of them is the ERC, or energy release component, which I think I understand is the potential for the fuels to erupt into flame. And the other one is the Haynes Index, which I don't understand. Well, I guess I don't understand either one, so I'm asking you to help us out.
Yeah, so energy release component is really more in Eric's territory, but essentially it's the energy produced by the fire. So the higher the number, the more energy that is being produced by the fire. And we kind of equate that to, from a satellite viewpoint, of fire radiative power. So how much energy we're seeing coming out of fire on the landscape. And then the Haynes Index is a measure of instability in the atmosphere. So it's telling us what the natural state of the atmosphere is to be unstable outside of the fire influence itself. And so for years, that has been used as an indicator for large fire growth. But more recent science is really telling us that linkage is not scientifically valid. And so we're moving to more classic indices now with regard to instability for prediction with wildfires.
So what would the other indices be?
Well, we have a variety of other stability indices that we use for severe weather. And we're starting to look at those for wildfire purposes. And also we have, as your viewer or your listener pointed out just a little bit ago, there's an index actually called the Hot, Dry, and Windy Index. And we're using that one as well and finding that has some pretty good linkage to large fire growth as well, as you can imagine.
All right. So a chance to bust some myths here. What are the things that you guys would want people to know about fires and fire weather and fire behavior, Eric?
Fire behavior is not as unpredictable in general. Now, some of what we talked about is the exception, but fire behavior is not as unpredictable as one might hear sometimes in the media. And we never lose any acres. We never consume any acres in fire. We know where they all are. They're still out there. But the biomass has changed significantly through rapid oxidation.
Rapid oxidation meaning fire?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And then, Robin, what are some of the things that you think people should know that they might be laboring under some misapprehensions about weathers and fire, weather and fires?
So I'd like to talk a little bit about the difference between a red flag warning and a fire warning.
Mm-hmm.
A red flag warning, like we talked about earlier, is issued from the National Weather Service. It is for the weather conditions, and it's not necessarily with a fire ignition on the landscape, right? It's for the weather conditions, and if a start were to occur, or if a fire is ongoing, that you would anticipate this extreme fire behavior. So that's red flag warning. So when you think of red flag warning, think of weather. And fire warnings are actually issued by the land management agency, the local sheriff's office, emergency manager, whoever that might be, for that piece of ground. It's disseminated through the National Weather Service. We don't issue it ourselves. And those are the warnings that actually tell you there is a fire on the landscape, and it's likely followed by some directions for the public what to do. Maybe an evacuation order is in effect, those types of things. So red flag warning, weather, fire warning, fire, and potential evacuation evacuation notices.
Now, I mentioned I had a chance to look at some 1 and 3 month outlooks, and it looks like a lot of the same conditions across the country, certainly through August and September. For October, Robin, I see Oregon and the rest of the Northwest seeing a decline potentially in significant wildland fire outlook, but California, not surprisingly, not so much.
Yeah, as we get into the fall time of year, California tends to see their offshore flow season, meaning that you get these high-pressure centers that come into the Great Basin and turn the wind direction for California and the shoreline areas out into the ocean. So as you can imagine, if the wind is not coming in from the ocean, but it's rather coming from the mountains out to the ocean, that's going to be a drier flow for them. It's going to lower their relative humidity values. A lot of times it warms them because as the wind comes down off the slopes of the mountains, it heats and it warms. And so that can be a time of year that can be rather risky for the California locations with regard to fire activity and fire growth, particularly in the coastal mountains and coastal areas. So that's why you're not seeing the relief anticipated in those areas as we get into the fall months.
Yeah, we got a real taste of that last year with the easterly winds that contributed to the fires in Oregon just after Labor Day. So, yeah, not just limited to California, it appears, anymore. Eric Christensen is a retired federal fire behavior analyst. Robin Heffernan is still working with the National Oceanic and Atmosphere Administration as a fire weather science and dissemination meteorologist. Thank you both for giving us an education on fires and weather today.